Welcome, everybody. This is the fourth lecture on supply and demand for the Mises Academy online class, Principles of Economics. With me, Robert Murphy, this is the spring 2012 version of the class. So as this outline suggests, we're going to be covering supply and demand tonight, and this will be the lecture where you'll see why we switched over to using the pen and the bamboo, whatchamacallit, I don't know what this thing is called, but it will really pay dividends tonight, the fact that we've been struggling with my poor handwriting up till now, because we're going to be doing lots of supply and demand curves, and that was the one thing, all the previous times I taught this class for the Mises Academy was this particular lecture, and then later on in the course, when we have to use supply and demand curves, it was really awkward for me to have to, I was like having to do PowerPoints and like do them in succession, sort of like when you're little and you would draw little cartoons like on a flip pad and they would, that's kind of how I was having to draw supply and demand on a PowerPoint. So it will be a lot better tonight for you guys. Okay, so the big picture, let's just step back for a second before we jump into this. Let me make sure you guys get what we're doing. All right, so again, tonight we're talking about supply and demand curves. This is going to be the lecture that is the closest to just standard regular economics, right? So what I'm going to teach you guys tonight is exactly what you would learn if you went to a regular micro class at college somewhere, all right? I would like to think that it's going to be clearer coming from me, that I think I explain what these things are a little bit better than the average economist, but the point is there's no newfangled theory I'm giving you here. This isn't some Austrian twist. This is just standard stuff. But I think it's important, and the reason I included this in the textbook, Lessons for the Young Economist, and why I want to go over it with you guys, is it really does help to clarify your thinking. And so remember, it's not that there is a theory of supply and demand. Okay, so it's not like various people have different ideas about how prices are formed, and economists offer up this theory of supply and demand, and some other group might come and give some other theory. That's not really the best way of thinking about it, okay? Because remember, supply and demand, it's not a theory in the sense that it could be false. Okay, so there's no observation that could ever come to light. It's not like people could go out and take measurements or record prices and quantities over a three-month period and then go look at it and go, oh my gosh, this violates the laws of supply and demand. You know, I hope economists don't see this, otherwise they're going to be really embarrassed. That can't ever happen, right? What supply and demand is, it's a framework for interpreting the world, right? So it might be a bad framework, so that's what could possibly happen. It might be economists 200 years from now don't even use supply and demand because maybe they will have found some other framework that just is less awkward or you know, it's more convenient, more useful in explaining things. But what supply and demand is, it's our framework for classifying different influences. Okay, so I'm being real abstract here just to try to give you the big picture, and then once we start doing it, it'll seem like, oh, yeah, this is what I thought of as normal economics. So don't worry. We're going to get to the standard stuff in a second here, but I just want to make sure you guys realize what it is that we're doing before we jump in and start doing it. So what we're ultimately trying to do, what's the whole point of this? The purpose is economists want to be able to explain market prices. We want to be able to say why prices are what they are, and really what we want to be able to do is to explain why they move one way or the other. That's really what we want to be able to do in our role as economists, is to give an explanation. So what we do when we're using a supply and demand framework is we say, okay, we think, you know, there's all sorts of different things that could affect prices. And so what we're going to do is divide things up and focus on the one hand on the suppliers, the people who are in a position to bring the good or the service, various units of it, to the market and sell it for money. And we're also going to look at the demand side, the people who are going to come to the market with money in hand and are considering buying one or more units of the good or service. Okay, so that's one decision that we're making, is that's the first pass, is we're going to divide the market up into the suppliers and the demanders, or the producers and the consumers, you know, whatever, however you want to label them. But that's one decision we're making. Then we're going to say, looking at each group of people now, we want to sort of capture or classify every possible thing that could influence how many units they either want to sell or buy, except the price of the object. Okay, so we're going to separate those two things, right? So again, first we separate the market into the suppliers and the demanders, and then looking at the suppliers, we're going to say, now, of all the possible things that could affect how much a particular supplier wants to bring to market, how many units, we're going to divide all those possible influences into two categories. On the one hand, it's going to be the price, the current price of the item in question, because that could have an influence, right? Depending on the price of the object, that might affect how many units the supplier wants to sell. And then the other box is everything else. And that's what we're doing with supply. And then with demand, we do a similar thing. We say, okay, we're looking at all the people that might buy this thing. Now, there's, in principle, there's billions of different factors that could go into motivating them to buy more or fewer units. And we're going to just divide those into two broad categories, the price of the object and everything else. Okay, so you see here, what I'm doing, it's not a theory. It doesn't matter what motivates people. I mean, clearly, I can always look at a situation, divide it up into the people that are possibly selling the object and the people possibly buying it, and then look at all the things that could be influencing their decisions and divide it up into two categories, the price of the object and everything else. See what I'm saying? So it's just a way of parsing the world. It's just a classification scheme. It's just a bunch of different categories we're going to start plugging stuff into. And we think, as economists in this tradition at least, we say, you know what? We've been dividing the world up into these categories and explaining price movements with this framework, and we think it's pretty useful. So that's why we're teaching it to students. Okay, so that's the big picture of what we're doing. So I'm going to teach you that framework tonight. Why is it useful? Because it really does, I think, give you a good mental framework for interpreting things. Because here's what you don't want to do. So in terms of practical applications, once you've absorbed the lesson from tonight, what's lesson 11 in the textbook, if you get the basics of it and understand it, you will be able to avoid making silly mistakes like this. So it's common, I don't know if I reproduced it in the textbook or not, but you'll be able to read something in the newspaper, or you'll watch TV and hear it, and they'll say something like this. They'll say something like, gasoline prices have risen sharply in the last few weeks. So which will lead motorists to cut back on their purchase of gasoline. But then the lower demand from the consumers should act to push down prices, and so that should provide some relief in the coming months. Okay, you say something like that. So look at what I just did there. I said high gasoline prices are going to cause low gasoline prices, and so I just contradicted myself. All right. So now there's an element of truth in everything I just said, but my point is, when you put all those together, That was a nonsense statement, okay? So again, just let me be clear in case you guys are like scribbling notes furiously. What I just said is bad. That's not good analysis. You don't want to say that high prices leads to low prices, okay? Because then that would suggest that prices are never stable, right? If high prices always lead to low prices, then prices are always bouncing around, right? Because I could just use the exact same thing. I could say, oh, at the lower gasoline prices, now consumers want to buy more, so the increase in demand pushes up the price. So you see, some prices would just be bouncing around forever. And that little framework that I gave, like when I was pretending to be the newscaster. Okay, so by the end of tonight's lecture, you should be able to realize, and if I have time and if I remember, I'll try to come back and to this example and say to you, okay, remember what I said in the beginning? Now you guys know exactly what I said that was wrong there. So again, each little part was is okay, but when you string it all together, you reach a nonsense conclusion. So what we're trying to do by teaching you this stuff, it's not so much that it's important that in the real world, you be able to pull out a piece of paper and start drawing supply and demand curves. That's not really the issue. But what is important is that you understand these distinctions I'm going to give you tonight so that in the real world, when something happens, you have a mental framework and you can say, hey, is that going to change supply or is that going to change demand? So what's that going to do to prices and quantities? So it just gives you a way to adequately classify or categorize what sort of change it is, and then you'll know qualitatively what that's going to do to the equilibrium. Okay. So demand. Now, I am relying on some of the older PowerPoints from when I taught this class before. At this point, I have no idea why I included this picture from the movie Misery, but I couldn't possibly delete this picture, so I just left it in there. Okay, so demand. What is the definition of demand? It is the relationship between various hypothetical prices for a good or a service and the total number of units that that consumers want to buy at each hypothetical price. Okay, so I'm stressing this. I'm typing it out here and everything. Obviously, it's in the textbook too. Because, and what I put that word in italics, relationship. So I want to get you to see here, demand is not, you can write that, that's how important this is. Demand is not a number. Okay? Instead, demand is a relationship. All right, so just remember that, and it'll help you make sense of these lessons I'm going to teach you in a little bit here, okay? So again, so that's why you got to be careful. Let me anticipate where we're going to go with this, and then I'll reiterate it once we make the point officially in a few minutes. When you say, oh, the demand for something increased, that doesn't mean that something went from 5 to 8. That means the entire relationship shifted. Okay, so because again, demand is not just some number. Demand is this entire relationship. It's a relationship between various pairs of numbers. That helps you to think about it. Okay, at this point, instead of being real abstract, it's going to be easier if we just jump into an example. Okay, I don't know how well this is coming through for you guys to be able to see here. So I'll read these numbers out loud in case it's hard for you to see, but I had to shrink the slide a little bit to give myself room to write. So, and all these numerical examples are coming from Chapter 11. So again, for people who tuned in late here, I am walking through Lesson 11, Supply and Demand, from your textbook. So if you have the physical book handy, it probably would help you to have that out here. Okay, so first of all, we're going to be talking about what a demand schedule is. Demand schedule. So that's this thing right here. So the schedule means it just lists the price in one column and then the quantity in the other. So this is the schedule for Jennifer. What is it? It's her demand for gasoline on a Tuesday afternoon. Right? There's nothing magical about that particular time. Like I could have said Jennifer's demand for gasoline in October of 2010. Or I could have said Jennifer's demand for gasoline between 3 and 4 p.m. on Tuesday and given a specific date, right? So the time interval doesn't matter, but the point is technically we do have a time interval in mind when we start talking about demand, because we're going to be saying at various hypothetical prices, how many units of the good or service does the person want to buy? So to answer that question, we would need enough information to say, well, what, when are we talking about here? Because obviously Jennifer's demand for gasoline on Tuesday afternoon is different from her demand for gasoline in the year 2010. Okay, so now what, just make sure you understand how to read this chart. So like here, the price at $5, how much does she buy? She buys zero. The price is lower at $4, she still buys zero. But when it drops down to $3.50, now she buys 1.5 gallons. If the price is $3 a gallon, she buys more, 2.5 gallons, and so on. Okay, and in the textbook, I gave little stories to explain these particular numbers. Right, so she has enough, for example, like she has enough gas in her car that she could get to work the next day. Right, so when she's driving by the pump and she sees it's $5 a gallon, she's thinking, what the heck, that's crazy, that's way too high. And so she just keeps going because she knows she can get it for cheaper elsewhere. But then it starts getting to be a reasonable range and she might stop and get just enough, you know, to get her through the next few days. If it gets to be really cheap, she filled up her tank. All right, and so that's why, like down here, whether it's $1.50 a gallon, the most I have her getting is, what does that say, 14.7, I think, because I was assuming that was the only, that's the spare capacity in her tank, right? After she puts in 14.7 gallons, you know, it's full, and it's not like she has a gas can in her trunk or something to fill up more. So even though it's ridiculously cheap, 50 cents a gallon, the most she's going to get is 14.7, okay? So the way I chose these numbers, they obey what's called the law of demand. So the law of demand says that as the price goes down, the quantity demanded either stays the same or increases. Okay, so you can just look at those numbers and see that Jennifer's demand schedule obeys the law of demand. Okay, so what would it look like? So that's the schedule. So this, let me put it to you this way. So the demand, Jennifer's demand, is just this relationship. The fact that at $5 she would buy zero, at $4 she would buy zero, at $3.50 she would buy 1.5, and so on. That's what demand is, it's that relationship. The demand schedule is a particular way of showing the relationship, namely by writing it out in column form. Another way we could show the demand would be to graph it. And so I could do that over here. All right, so when you graph stuff in economics, typically you're going to put the price on the y-axis and quantity on the x-axis, if you're familiar with graphing stuff in the xy plane from just regular math classes. Let me very briefly just mention his one little thing for those of you who are super achievers. So if you don't know what I'm talking about for the next 30 seconds, don't worry about it. For those of you who are comfortable with graphing and you're, you know, you're good at math, you might be wondering, why are we putting price on the y-axis and quantity on the x-axis when typically we make the independent variable on the x and the dependent variable on the y? So like if you were going to graph your weight is a function of how many calories you eat per day or something like that, you would almost certainly put the calories on the bottom x-axis and then have the weight be on the y to respond to. That's just the natural way you would do it. So here it's kind of odd that we're speaking of price being the thing that's independent, and then we ask for a various price, what's the corresponding quantity? So you might think that we would put Q on the Y and P on the X. And the reason we don't is just historically, Alfred Marshall was the economist who first really started, you know, making these graphs popular. And he, when he introduced the idea, or made it popular at least, he actually did think in terms of, this is what the quantity is, now what does the price have to be to fit? So he did think in terms of the quantity being the independent variable and then the price responding, whereas now it's more common for economists to think in terms of, tell me what the price is first, now I'll tell you what the quantity is. Okay, so again, if I just launched there, don't worry about it. That's a little inside baseball thing. Okay, but now graphing this, so the price and the quantity, this, I'm not going to do a very accurate graph here. I just want to make sure you understand how you would go from the schedule to the graph. So I just want to make sure I have room to fit everything. So the price up here, what's the biggest price, is $5. So I'll make that the top one. And then, you know, there's 50 cents. And then there would be a dollar, and I probably already am a little bit off in terms of the spacing. And that's $2, and that's $3, and that's $4. Okay, so I'm already off on the spacing, but you get the idea. So then each of these pairs of numbers here is going to be 1 point on the graph. And the quantity starts at 0 and it goes up to what, 14.7, so I'll just say that's 15. Okay, so this first pair right here, at $5, she would buy 0, so it's 5, 0, so I'll put a dot right there, so $5 and 0 units of gas. So this is how many gallons. That's what this axis is. Right, whereas this axis is how many dollars. And to be clear, it's dollars per gallon. So this price doesn't mean how much total money is she paying to the gas station. It's saying how many dollars per gallon of gasoline. And then it's saying at that unit price, how many units does she want to buy. Okay, at $4, it's also 0. So that would be like that. At $3.50, it's 1.5. So let's just say that that's 2. Oops, I'm sorry. Let's say that's 1. And that's 2. So 1.5 would be halfway in between. So at $3.50, which is like right there on the thing, you go over. It's right about there. And then at it's 2.50. Or 2.5, I should say. So it's like right there. And then at 2.5, it's 4. Something like that. Okay, and so on. I'm getting low on time here, so I'm going to just stop that. But the point is, if you connected them, you would start to see something like that. Okay, so what I've done, so both of these are representations of her demand. The thing on the left is the demand schedule. The thing on the right would be a demand curve. Okay. This now is the market demand schedule on this slide. Okay. So we just spent a lot of time there going over Jennifer. So this right here, this column, is this, in case, you know, just to make sure you understand that. All right, and then all I did was I said, in addition to Jennifer, I made up numbers for Beth, Jim, Dave, Hank, and Jill. Okay, so this, you know, this second column here is the demand schedule for Beth. And this column right here is the demand schedule for Jim, and so on. So the point is, what we did for Jennifer there, and what we walked through in painstaking detail, we're not going to do it for these other people because it would be a waste of time, but we could in principle. All right, so I'm hoping it makes sense to you guys what it means to ask at various hypothetical prices of gasoline, how many units would they buy? Let me be clear, it's hypothetical. So what we mean is, at this given point in time, Tuesday afternoon, we have a particular Tuesday afternoon in mind. So it's not that we could see the price of gas changing over time and then map these things out. We're saying, no, right now, this particular Tuesday afternoon, what if gas happened to be $7 a gallon? How many units would these people buy? And so you see Jennifer would buy zero, Beth would buy zero, this guy Jim would actually buy half a gallon, Dave would buy a gallon, this guy Hank would buy 13, and Jill would buy zero. And you say, why would Hank buy 13? And look at it, Hank is 13 no matter what. That's weird. Why is he doing that? Well, the story I told in the textbook was, I said Hank is on a business trip. You know, he's driving on the interstate and he's almost out of gas, so he's pulling off to fill up his tank, and he's not paying for it. In other words, he's going to like save the receipt and get reimbursed from his company. So he doesn't really care what the price is. He's just, you know, he's just anxious to get to the hotel or whatever he's doing. And so he pulls in the station at $7 a gallon, I don't care. He fills up all 13 gallons. Or if it's $1 a gallon, great, I'm filling it up either way. Whereas these other people are more responsive to the price because they're, you know, they're ultimately paying for it, whereas Hank's just getting reimbursed from his employer. Okay, so anyway, notice each of these people, their individual respective demand schedules individually obeys the law of demand. So even Hank, it's still true for Hank that as price goes down, the quantity he demands either increases or stays the same. In his case, it stays the same. But the point is, if gasoline gets cheaper, the law of demand says it can't be that somebody all of a sudden would want to buy fewer units. That's the only thing the law of demand would rule out. But you can still buy the same number of units. Okay. So now what's the market demand? It's simply the summation. So the market sums across the rows. So the market demand says, like, let's take the price $5.50. The market demand is 17 units. Where is that coming from? It's adding up all these numbers. Right, so it's 0 plus 0 plus 1 plus 3 plus 13 plus 0. And thank goodness that adds to 17 and I didn't make a mistake in the live lecture. Right? Down here, at a price of $3 a gallon, what's the market demand? It's 34.5 gallons. Where is that coming from? Again, it's adding up all of these individual quantities demanded at that particular price. All right, so the market demand is just the summation of all the individual demands. So the market demand, what we're saying is, at various hypothetical prices, how many units do all potential consumers in this market want to buy? That's the market demand is. The last thing on this slide to point out is, notice the market demand obeys the law of demand as well. And that follows. If each individual demand schedule obeys it, then when you add them up, the summation is going to obey the law of demand too. So I'm not going to prove that rigorously, but if you think about it, that makes sense. Okay. And then here I charted the market demand for gasoline. So this is what we would call a demand curve. And so notice it's not a nice smooth thing. And here I just plotted the individual points. If you wanted to, you could connect them. Okay, next slide. Textbook demand curves. So what I mean here is we just showed you, you know, I just came up with some plausible numbers for a hypothetical example, and then we plotted the actual result. And it was this thing that looks kind of ugly, but it's fairly realistic. In contrast, in a standard economics introductory course, when you start doing textbook demand curves, meaning when you start working with examples, you aren't going to actually use real numbers, right? Certainly not in this class. It depends, I guess. If you went on and took a more advanced one, you might use actual numbers, or they might make you do one or two with real numbers just to make sure you know what you're doing and plot the points and stuff. But when you start doing the sorts of examples that we're going to do later tonight, giving hypothetical changes and then saying what's going to happen to price and quantity, you're not going to be working with those ugly, cumbersome things because it just takes too long. So instead, if you look in standard economics books at the undergraduate level, they're going to look one of two ways. Okay, so remember, you always are going to have price being on that, the y-axis, and Q being the x-axis, P for price and Q for quantity. And then what are we doing, demand curves? So it might look something like that, and they might draw D right next to it. Okay, so it's an actual curve, meaning it's curvy. That's what I'm getting at there. I don't mean it's actual, like it's corresponding to real numbers that we did in the schedule. I mean it's an actual curve. Or when you get really lazy, what we'll do is we won't even draw curves anymore. It'll just be a straight line. We'll put a D next to that. So yep, that's the demand curve. So I'm going over this just to make sure I don't lose somebody, because it's the first time I taught a guest lecture somewhere, and I was going through supply and demand, and I drew the straight line, and a girl raised her hand in the front and was like, why are you guys calling that a demand curve? It's not, it's a line. Like, that was such a, you know, basic question, like I didn't even know how to answer, and I was like, so anyway, that's why I'm going over this now, because I realize that, yeah, that is kind of weird. Why are you calling that a curve if it's not a curve? So the point is, when we are doing this stuff, the examples we're going to be working on in about 15 minutes from now, this is what I'm going to be drawing. I'm going to be drawing, that's supposed to be a straight line, it's just, I'm still not great with this bamboo deal. Straight line, and yet that's the thing I'm going to be calling a demand curve. Okay, this one over here, you would occasionally see, but it's more typical for people to work. Yeah, now it does look like bacon. It's more typical for economists in practice when they're teaching stuff at the intro level to be using just a straight line. Why is that? Because the simple answer is it's just easier to diagram. It's easier to keep things straight, no pun intended, if you're using straight lines. If you had curvy lines, if you weren't careful, you could get mixed up. Because what's going to happen is, I'm getting ahead of myself, so don't worry here. I just want to show you the graphing logistical problems. Let's say I wanted to make the demand curve shift left. If I'm doing these curvy ones, and I start to draw that one, like I have to really scrunch it in here, and I get worried, and it's, you know, it gets all, if you don't start properly, you could like box yourself into a corner. Whereas if you're just drawing straight lines, it's easier for me just to say, oh, I made the demand curve move left. And it's easier for me to look ahead when I start drawing the thing to see how it's going to end up if I'm just drawing straight lines. So that's the main reason. So there's no economic reason at all to be using straight lines for supply and demand curves. It's just a matter of graphing convenience. In fact, this thing makes more sense economically, but we're not going to get into that. That's too advanced. If somebody in the Q&A wants to ask me why, I can go over it, but I don't even want to go into it right now because it's too complicated. Okay. So now that we understand demand, let's move on to supply. And again, I don't remember why I included a picture of a bunch of spam, but how could I possibly take out that photo once it was in there? Okay, supply, what's the definition? Again, it's the relationship between various hypothetical prices for a good or a service and the total number of units the producers want to sell at each hypothetical price. Let me stress, so with demand, I jumped up and down about this word relationship. So here, let me jump up and down about something else. It's want to sell at each hypothetical price. And then with demand, I'm hoping I had said something similar. Oops. Put a little mustache on her before she smacks her knees with that thing. Okay, demand is the relationship that the consumers want to buy. Okay, so what I'm stressing now is these things might not be achieved, might not be realized. And we're going to see that in a little while in this lecture. Okay, so don't think that supply is how much the producer does in fact sell, and don't think that demand is how many units the consumer does in fact purchase. Rather, demand and supply are saying at each hypothetical price, how much would the consumer want to or desire to purchase, and how much would the supplier want to or desire to sell? Okay, because that's kind of the point here, is we're going to see what's special about the equilibrium price is that's the price where those two quantities are equal. So both parties, or both sides, I should say, can realize their desires. But at prices that aren't equilibrium, the numbers don't match up, and so it can't be. It's physically impossible for both people to achieve what they want at the same time because the numbers don't add up, literally. All right, so that's why I'm stressing in the definition here. When we're defining what is supply and what is demand, it's not how much in practice or in fact that they do sell or buy. It's how much do they want to sell or buy for the suppliers and the consumers respectively. Okay. So here I'm skipping steps since we kind of walked through the demand side carefully. So here I'm jumping right into the supply schedule for a few firms or a few individual suppliers and just showing it with the market as well. So right here, it's a supply schedule, right? It's showing hypothetical prices for gasoline. And again, these are unit prices. This is saying price per gallon. And then we're saying there's three different individuals on the supply side. There's the Quick Mart, the Filler Up, and the Sky Farmer Jim. So, for example, if the price is $1.50 or less per gallon, nobody sells anything. Nobody brings any units to market. Oops, I'm sorry, I misread that. Filler Up brings 5 units to market, and that's why you see 5 over there. If the price is $1 or 50 cents or 0, then nobody brings anything. What is the law of supply? The law of supply, as you probably can guess, says as the price goes up, the quantity supplied either stays the same or increases. So notice here, Quick Mart, Filler Up, and Farmer Jim all obey the law of supply. That as the price goes up here, that price goes up, notice that these amounts either stay the same or they get bigger. They don't have to always get bigger with each increase in price, but the point is they can't go down. Okay. Let me make a point before I forget. When we talk about a demand schedule or a supply schedule, we're holding everything else fixed or constant, right? So we're saying everything else being equal on Tuesday afternoon, what if the one thing we changed were the price of gasoline now? Now you tell me how many units of gas would Jennifer want to buy if gas is $1 a gallon? What if it's $1.50 a gallon? What if it's $2 a gallon? But we hold everything else constant. So we wouldn't say, suppose the price of gasoline went, you know, were $2 and Jennifer doesn't have a car, and now suppose the price of gasoline is $4 a gallon and Jennifer all of a sudden gets a new SUV that she needs to fill up. You see, then we would be changing two things. So you can't do that. That's not what a demand schedule or a supply schedule does. What they do is they lock everything else down. They say, okay, you know, in your head, think about all those other things. Now keep them fixed. Now we're going to start changing a hypothetical price. And for each hypothetical price I throw out, you tell me, given that that person has identical circumstances in every other way, the only thing that we've changed is the price of gas per gallon. Now how many units does this person want to buy? And that's what the demand schedule is. And to say how many units these people want to sell, that's what the supply schedule is. All right, so what were the stories here? In the interest of time, let me just, I think these ones are fairly straightforward. Farmer Jim, what's going on with him? Why does he have zero all the way up, but then it's $6 and $6.50 and $7. All of a sudden, he sells 20 units. Well, I think it was because in his tractor, or he had some gasoline in storage that he used for his tractor, because he didn't want to like have to keep running to the gas station or something like that. And so, at the normal range of prices, and even for a relatively high price like $5.50 a gallon, he's not going to do anything. But all of a sudden, gasoline hits $6, $6.50, $7 a gallon. Again, other things being equal, so you know he's having a normal day, and all of a sudden, gas is $7 a gallon. He's going to run it and bring out his 20 gallons that he had, you know, in the barn for his tractor or whatever, and then he's going to set up a stand or something on the side of the road and say, "Hey, I'll sell you this gasoline for $7 a gallon." And he'll sell all 20 gallons. Okay, so it's not worth it to him to go to the hassle of going in and taking out his, you know, because maybe he paid $3 for it, and he expects next week the price to be back to $3. He's just baffled. Why is gasoline $7 a gallon? That's crazy. He expects it to be back to normal next week. And so at a price of $7 a gallon, it would be worth it to him to haul out his gasoline and sit there for a few minutes trying to flag down cars and sell it to somebody. That's the sort of contrived story. Okay, and again, the market supply, you're going this way with it. So at $7 a gallon, the quantity supplied by the market is 270. It's 200 supplied by Filler Up, 50 by the Quick Mart, and 20 by Farmer Jim. So you add that up, that adds up to 270. And since each individual obeys the law of supply, so does the market. And if you were to plot those points that we just did on a supply schedule there, they would look like this. Okay, so the textbook supply curves, again, just following what we did with demand. Have your P and your Q. And if it's actually curvy, it would look something like that. But we rarely do that in practice. Normally, if we're going to do a supply curve, we just literally do a straight line. And we might make the angle steeper or more shallow depending on the situation, which we'll see. One thing that let me just mention before we move on here, notice what does it mean, what does the law of supply mean in terms of these curves? the law of supply implies that supply curves are upward sloping. Okay, you see what I'm saying? It goes up. And if you just think about it, that has to be true, right? Because you got price here and quantity here. So remember, what does the law of supply say? It says that as price goes up, the quantity either has to stay the same or go up. So if you're graphing something that obeys that, it's going to be going up. It might be flat, you know, it might be like flat and then go up more and be flat and go up. But the point is, you can't have something going down. That would be a violation of the law of supply. And the same thing if we flip back for a second to demand. The law of demand implies that demand curves are downward sloping. All right. Oops. Okay, so now we're going to talk about equilibrium. Okay, so I walked through that stuff fairly slowly because I wanted to make sure you guys had the basic fundamentals. And now I'm going to speed it up a little bit because of the clock here. All right, so now when you put the two things together, how do you do it? So always, 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 you draw your original thing and you put your P up there and your Q down here to label the axes. And then if it's just a standard diagram and we don't have any more information, we don't know what shape to make these things, you just do something like this. Upward sloping supply curve, downward sloping demand curve. And then now that we put the two together, something special happens at this intersection. So if I draw a dotted line left, I'll call that P star. And if I draw a dotted line straight down, I'll call that Q star. All right, so those are supposed to be perfectly level straight lines, in case that's not obvious to you guys, that they actually veered a little bit, but that's just because I'm still not a master artist with this equipment. All right, so what's special about the equilibrium price and the equilibrium quantity? Well, the equilibrium price is the price such that quantity demanded equals quantity supplied. All right, just look at the chart and see that at this particular price, P star, what is true? You say, oh, what's the quantity supply? Well, you start at P star, and how do you figure that out? How do you figure out what the quantity supplied is? Well, if you've got a supply curve, it just means you start at the P that you're talking about, and you go right until you hit the supply curve, and then you go straight down. And that Q is the quantity supplied. That's what it means to graph that thing. So remember, this graph of the supply here is just all the points relating hypothetical prices to hypothetical quantities. And so that's what this line is. It's just a collection of points that we connected with a straight line. And then the same thing with the demand. Remember, this demand curve, what is it? It's just the relationship between all these hypothetical prices and the corresponding quantities that are demanded at each hypothetical price. So if I say at this P star, hey, what's the quantity demanded happen to be at this P star? So, okay, well, the way I answer that is I start at this P right here, and then I go right until I hit the demand curve. Bam, then I go straight down. Oh, and that Q right there, that's the quantity demanded at that particular price that you just told me. So since I picked that P to be exactly where those two lines intersect, then that means those Qs are going to be the same. Okay. surplus and shortage. So make sure you understand this, what I'm doing in this slide, because this will come up when we do price controls, which will be, is that next week? Might be. Okay, so in case some of you are bad at graphing and you're like, what the heck is this? I thought we were taking economics classes, not doing math exercises. The reason I'm going through this is because it's crystal clear what happens with when the government does price controls, like rent control laws or minimum wage laws. It takes 2 seconds to show that stuff graphically if you've taken the time to understand what the graphs mean. So again, one last plug before I jump back into this. If you've been resisting thinking, oh, I don't really need to learn this stuff, I just hate the government, just want to figure out why the government's so bad, I don't really care about graphing, well, you can really see how much the government screws things up if you learn these techniques. Okay, so surplus and sort. I'm going to draw a bigger one here to give myself room. Okay, so P and Q. S and D. All right, so there's the intersection point. So that's the P star. That's the equilibrium price. And that's Q star. That's the equilibrium quantity. Now, what would happen? So now we've defined equilibrium price and quantity. But we can go further and say we think there's a tendency in a regular market where, you know, there's not government intervention, there's regular market forces, there's a tendency for the price to move towards equilibrium and for the quantity to move towards equilibrium as well. So what's the story there? Well, suppose for some reason the price happened to be higher than the equilibrium price. So I'll draw a P here and I'll put a little H as a superscript to stand for price that's high. Okay? So you see what I'm saying? That this is this much higher on the price axis than the equilibrium price is. Okay? So at PH, what happens? Okay, well, what is the quantity demanded? How do you figure that out? You just start up here and you go to the right, boom, 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 until you hit the demand curve right there, and then you drop down. Okay, so I'll say quantity demanded H at the high price. All right, at this high price, what's the quantity supplied? Well, how do you figure that out? You start at this price and you go over, do 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 do, bam, until you hit the supply curve. Then you stop and you drop down. And so this is the quantity that's supplied at the high price. So that's an S and an H, in case you can't read that. All right, so make sure you get what I'm doing there. When I start at a particular hypothetical price and then I go to the right until I hit the demand or the supply curve, I'm just using what those things are. So by definition, the supply curve says it's plotting the relationship between possible prices and the quantity supplied. So that's why now if I just pick some price like PH and say what's the quantity demanded and quantity supplied, that's how I figure that out. I just start at that height and then go right until I hit the relevant curve and then go down, and that gives me the, you know, the left right distance on the x-axis is the quantity. Okay, so those two numbers aren't the same, right? This QDH is smaller than QSH. The quantity demanded at this high price is less than the quantity supplied. So what do? We call this thing right here a surplus or a glut. right? Because there's more producers are trying to sell more units at that price than consumers want to buy. So remember before when I said it, supply and demand refer to their desires or how much they want to buy and sell. So that's the thing here. So the suppliers are walking away unhappy. They said, man, at this price, I wanted to sell, whatever, 1,000 units, but I could only actually sell 600. So I'm disappointed. So what happens in that situation? Well, the suppliers now who came to market thinking they were going to be able to unload this whole amount at the higher price, now they realize they could only sell this amount, and so they're stuck with this surplus. So what are they going to do? Well, they're probably going to lower their price to get rid of it. So there'll be a downward pressure on prices. All right, so notice what I just did there. I picked some hypothetical price, PH, that was above the equilibrium price, and I showed that there's going to be a surplus at that price. And as long as you have normal-looking supply and demand curves, that's always going to be true. All right, if I have a standard-looking supply and demand curve with supplies upward sloping and doesn't do any weird loops or anything, and the demand downward sloping, and they just intersect at one point, and then I say, what happens if I pick a price that's higher than that intersection? Well, then I'm always going to be in this region where the demand curve is to the left of the supply curve. So meaning any price in this region is going to give me a surplus. So if you buy the story that the producers were trying to sell more, now they're stuck with inventory that they don't want because they thought they were going to be able to sell it, what are they going to do? Well, they're probably going to lower prices. Then I've just given you a sort of generic story as to why prices that are too high will tend to be pushed back down towards the equilibrium price. Okay, now let's run through the whole thing again. Okay, I just thought it'd be easier to start from scratch instead of trying to do on the same thing. Okay, so now, get our original diagram up again. Supply and demand. There's the vaunted equilibrium point. We go to the left. Boom, that's P star. We go straight down. That's Q star. Now what would happen if for some reason the price happened to be PL? Meaning P lower, P low, a price that's lower than the equilibrium price. I won't spend as much time on this one, but you get the idea probably. You go over, boom, 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 hit the supply curve, come down. So this is the quantity supplied at the lower price. Go over until I hit the demand curve, go straight down. So that's the quantity demanded at the lower price. So now we have this gap there. What's that called? A shortage. Is what this gap between the quantity demanded and quantity supplied is. All right, so what happens in a shortage is the quantity demanded is higher than the quantity supplied. Right, so at that low price, these buyers are like, oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I'll buy a ton of units. And they all come to market anxious to buy all these units, but the suppliers are saying, at that low price, yeah, I'll sell these many, but no more. And the two don't add up. So the demanders are trying to buy more units than the suppliers want to offer. Remember, when we are talking about shortages or surpluses, the unit in question is not money. The unit in question is referring to the units of the good or the service. So if we're talking about gasoline, then we're talking about gallons. So if the price is too low, then the consumers want to buy more gallons of gasoline than the sellers want to sell. So this discrepancy, this shortage, would be denominated in gallons of gasoline. So maybe it would be, oh, there's a shortage of 40 gallons of gas, right? That's what these units down here are. These are the units of the good or service. These units are in money, but remember, it's dollars per unit of the good or service. So it's not just total dollars change in hands. It's dollars per unit of the good or service in question. Okay, last thing on this slide. So what happens then if the price is too low and you've got this shortage? Well, so remember now that the customers came to market wanting to buy a ton of this stuff and they see there's not much available, what's going to happen? Well, probably the price is going to get bid up. So either depending on the type of market, you can imagine the consumer saying, oh, well, don't sell it for $3, I'll give you $3.50. Or you can imagine if the supplier is the one who technically sets the price, you can imagine them saying, oh my gosh, we got lines out the door, we're going to run out at this price, let's raise our prices. Okay, so the point is the story would be different depending on the particular context, but I hope you find it plausible to say if the price is so low that people want to buy more units than sellers want to sell, that's going to put upward pressure on the price. So it's going to move up. Okay, so summing it all up then, let's do it one more time to get a nice clean one. Okay, so if the price is too high, remember that gave us a surplus, and that tended to push the price down. And what if the price is too low? Well, that gave us a shortage, and that tended to push the price up. And at P star, the equilibrium price, there is neither a shortage nor a surplus. At P star, that's the one price where the quantity supplied exactly equals the quantity demanded, and there's no reason, there's nothing pushing the price. All right, so it's a stable point. That's why we call it an equilibrium point. If the price is higher than P star, it gets knocked back down. If it's lower than P star, it gets knocked back up. If it's right at P star, it stays still. So that's the sense in which now we can say, given fixed supply and demand, if the supply and demand curves didn't move, and in the real world they would be moving, but if they were fixed, we would expect eventually the actual market price to zoom in on the equilibrium price and to stay there. All right. Now the really fun stuff. So what happens when things change? Okay. Incidentally, I just checked the Q&A thing. I don't see any Q&A, so if that means you don't have any questions, that's fine. If you do have questions, especially for this material, go ahead and start typing that stuff in, because my pacing through this discussion will depend on if I think there's questions waiting. But if you guys are utterly engrossed by my graphing skills, that's fine. We can do that too. Okay, so now what I'm doing, just to make sure you don't get lost, make sure I don't get lost, I am walking you guys through most of these examples coming from lesson 11. So this is, so the first one says example one, supply reduction. So it's on page 160 in my book. I guess there's only one edition so far. And so I'm going to walk, so I'm not going to cover every single one that's in the textbook, but I'm going to cover most of them. So that's what I'm doing right now in the remaining time we have here, is I'm walking you through these things. So what we're doing, just to give you the big picture here, is now we want to be in a position to say, okay, you guys know how to draw a standard supply and demand chart or curves, and then I'm going to give you a little story where something changes. And then we're going to say, what happens to price and quantity? So for all these things, it's not that we want you to say, oh, it goes up by 3.4%. You don't have enough information. You couldn't possibly know that. What you want to do is just to draw an original framework and then introduce the change and then say, because of that change, this is the direction that price and quantity would go. Okay, so this first example says, suppose that what we're considering is the market for crude oil. And we're at an initial equilibrium, and then all of a sudden the OPEC nations announce that they're going to cut back on how much oil they bring to market. What happens? Okay, so the way you would start answering a question like that is you'd say, okay, well, I'm going to draw my initial supply and demand. You could, if you want, you can put oil down here so that you know what that axis is referring to. And then draw S and draw D. Now what I'm going to do here, I just want to be consistent with what I do in the textbook so you guys don't get mixed up. Instead of me doing stars, I'm going to do numbers. So at this intersection here, I'm going to call that P1. And I'm going to call this Q1. To mean the initial thing, I can even put a 1 there if you want, a 1 there, a 1 there. So then when I change it, the new stuff's going to be 2, right? Because I don't want to draw a star, because the point is the star is going to change. So here, now the question, so this was the original equilibrium, and now we say, oh, what's the change? The OPEC nations announced to the world, hey, we're going to be pumping fewer barrels of oil and bringing it to market. And so now the question is, what's going to change? So the first thing you have to say to yourself is, well, so what's going to happen is we're going to move one of the curves, or possibly both, depending on the question. So that's always the trick to these sorts of things, is you want to say, given the little story that the teacher just told me, how do I break it down into moving one or more of these, one or both of these curves? All right, so if the OPEC countries bring fewer barrels of oil to market, what is that going to change? It's going to change the supply. Right? Because what that means now is at various hypothetical prices, fewer barrels of oil are going to be brought by suppliers to market. Okay? Because basically what they're saying is, you know, whatever our supply schedule was before, we're knocking off 300,000 barrels a day. Okay? So if you think that through, that what that means is that they're reducing their supply. So I'm going to just draw a new supply curve and call it S2. So this is what's called, you can see in the labels here, it's a supply reduction or a leftward shift in the supply curve. So do you see why it's called that? So it's a reduction in supply because now at various hypothetical prices, the quantity supplied is lower, right? So this pick, you know, this particular price right here, whatever that is, before they were bringing this much to market, now they're only bringing this much. Okay, so the supply is lower, but it's also graphically a leftward shift, right? Because you see how it looks like we just literally grabbed the supply curve and pulled it to the left. So it's not, I don't know what's easier for you to picture. Strictly speaking, we're not moving the curve. Strictly speaking, what we're doing is, with the new information, we're erasing the original curve and then redrawing the supply curve and it's over here on the, you know, to the left. But it's, for whatever reason, I think it's, it just seems easier if people think in terms of the curve moving around as opposed to erasing the first curve and drawing a brand new curve that happens to be to the left of the first one. All right, but if, again, I'm saying different things just to make sure in case someone's getting tripped up over like some philosophical issue that you don't worry about that. Another point is, in terms of the picture, you might say, well, why do we say a leftward shift in the supply curve? Couldn't we also describe this as an upward shift in the supply curve, right? If we just took this original S1 and just shifted the whole thing upward, wouldn't that end up where S2 is? Instead of describing it like Murphy just did, instead we took that original S1 curve and we shifted it to the left. So yes, those are equivalent ways to describe just the graph. However, that would be very confusing, okay, because this economically is a reduction in supply. So it would mess you up if the way you described graphically a reduction in supply was to say shift the supply curve up. See what I mean? So don't say that. So that's why I'm going to take my little eraser here and erase this thing. Okay, so yes, graphically speaking, when I draw that new S2 curve, I could equivalently describe that move as saying I took the original S1 curve and shifted it to the left, or I could say I grabbed it and I pulled it up. But economically, what this is describing is a reduction in supply, so it's less confusing to describe it graphically by saying it's a leftward shift of the supply curve. Okay, so don't call it an upward shift in supply. In general, when we're talking about moving the curves around, we're going to say left or right. We're not going to say up or down precisely for that reason, because we don't want to leave the door open to that kind of confusion. Okay, now the next question. The OPEC announcement, is that going to affect the demand for gasoline, or sorry, the demand for oil? And so here now, remember what we were talking about in the beginning of the lecture here. Now we're finally at the point where we can very precisely see what was wrong with that hypothetical newscaster's analysis that I went over in the very beginning of the lecture. And I remember I warned you guys saying, that was wrong, don't talk like that. So here now we're finally at that point. A lot of people are going to be tempted to jump ahead with this analysis here. So far, remember, we've said, okay, we had the original equilibrium with the price of P1 and the quantity of Q1, and then we stipulated for the sake of argument that OPEC reduces output at various hypothetical prices, and so we said, okay, well, clearly that's a reduction in supply, so I drew this new S2 curve, right, and labeled it with an S2, but now what happens on the demand side? So a lot of people are going to be tempted to say, oh, the demand went down too, because they're going to be looking ahead, and they think they know what the answer is. But no, the demand doesn't move at all. The demand, remember, is the relationship between hypothetical prices and the quantity demanded at those various prices. There is no reason for that to change because of what OPEC did, right? When I ask, think back to Jennifer, when I ask Jennifer, what's your demand for gasoline? So there I'd be talking about gasoline, here we're talking about oil, but just follow me with the concept here. Jennifer doesn't have to know anything about the supply. She doesn't care what the refiners are doing. She doesn't care if you know the big trucks that were bringing gas to the market got interrupted. She doesn't care if there's a hurricane that knocked out a refinery. She doesn't care what OPEC is doing and what happened to the price of crude oil. When you ask Jennifer at various prices for gasoline, how many gallons do you want to buy? The thought process she goes through doesn't have anything to do with that other stuff. Okay, and the similar thing here, the people that buy crude oil, like refiners, so their job is to take crude oil and then refine it into gasoline and into jet fuel and stuff like that. the refiners don't directly care about what OPEC's pumping decisions are. Now, what they do care about is the price of crude oil. That's true. So what OPEC does will ultimately matter to those people. Don't get me wrong. But my point is, it's not the demand schedule or the demand curve that moves. What ends up happening is, because OPEC cut output, the supply curve shifted left, and now, and the demand curve stayed the same. Because strictly speaking, the people who buy crude oil do not care about OPEC's pumping decisions. They just care about the price of crude oil, you know, the prices of the products they're making that use crude oil as an input, that sort of thing. So what ends up happening is, now at S2, it intersects with the original demand curve right here. And so now we get this new price, which I'll call P2. And now there's a lower quantity, which I'll call Q2. Okay, so what ended up happening, the price went up and the quantity went down. The equilibrium price went up and the equilibrium quantity went down. So if you want, I could have just drawn a whole new supply and demand diagram, but with this S2 instead of the original S1, and then had a P star and a Q star. But in order to keep it all on one graph, I'm not using stars anymore, I'm using ones and twos. So what I'm saying is, the original equilibrium price and quantity were P1 and Q1. Now we said, oh, OPEC changed, oop, what happened? Price went up and the quantity went down. All right, so this is important here. So what happened with the demand for oil? Again, the demand was the same. Demand was D1 originally, and it's D1 after OPEC makes the announcement. What ended up happening is the quantity demanded changed. So yeah, because supply shifted left, or because supply was reduced, the equilibrium price ended up rising, and so the quantity demanded fell, or another way of saying it is, we moved along the demand curve, right? So we started here on the demand curve, and then we moved up into the left to this point. Okay, so that's the distinction there. So there's a distinction between saying demand changed versus saying quantity demanded changed. Okay, I spent a lot of time on that, but I won't need as much for the subsequent ones. Also, I'm just looking at the clock here. I'm going to be able to go through this, but it's possible I'm going to go so fast that you're going to miss a few nuances. So probably what's going to happen for those of you who are really, you know, absorbing this, like, oh, wow, okay, I didn't understand that, you're going to need to, you know, watch this last, you know, you're going to need to get the video and watch this a couple times maybe, and, you know, stop it and do it on a piece of paper and make sure you follow what I'm doing. But again, with the time constraints here, I'm going to have to go fairly quickly. Okay, so the next example now is a demand reduction, a leftward shift in the demand curve. So this is actually example 3 from the textbook. So the story here is the price of oranges goes down, and now we're asking what happens to the apple market. Okay, so as always, we draw original thing, and so we don't get mixed up here. Let's write out what this thing is. So these are talking about apples. That's what this axis is, the quantity of apples. And then we have the original supply, original demand, original price, and the original quantity. So now the question again is, so this is the market for apples. We've got our equilibrium price and quantity of apples. And now we're saying, suppose all of a sudden the price of oranges goes down. What happens to the apple market? Okay, so is the supply curve of apples going to change because the price of oranges went down? Probably not. it would be hard to come up with a story whereby the price of oranges going down affects producers of apples' willingness to bring apples to market. Would the demand for apples change? Probably. Okay, because for many people, apples and oranges are substitutes. Right? That if you're going to the store and you want to buy some fruit and you see that oranges are on a really good sale, right? So the price of oranges is, you know, way down, you might load up on oranges, and so you're probably less likely to buy apples, even if apples had the same price as they did before. Okay, so that's the trick here. Remember, the demand curve is saying hold everything constant and just change the price of the good in question. So what this D1 means is hold everything else constant, including the price of oranges, and now we're just changing the price of apples, right? And so since it's downward sloping, that means as the price of apples goes down, the quantity of apples demanded increases. But now when I say, oh, wait a minute, other things aren't equal. Oranges now are really cheap this week. What happens? Now I have to draw a whole new demand curve. And probably you would find for a normal society that if oranges are all of a sudden cheaper, the demand for apples is going to be lower. So at the same price per pound of apples, you'll find people are now buying fewer bags of apples, fewer pounds of apples, because oranges are on sale. Okay, so that's why it's a demand reduction or a leftward shift in the demand curve. So I'll just do a new D2 like that, so you get the idea why it's a leftward shift, because here was the original demand curve, this D1, and here's the new demand curve, D2, and there's nothing magical about where I draw these new ones. It's just I'm drawing it far enough away so you can see the difference on this diagram. But, you know, from just the verbal story with no numbers, we have no idea, okay? And that's the whole point with these things, is this is just giving us qualitative ideas of which direction the P's and the Q's are going to change. It's not a quantitative, oh, it's going to go up by 14%. We have no idea. But this is just to help you to think through so that you know if oranges all of a sudden got cheaper, what would probably happen to the apple market. Okay, so now this new D2, what can we say? Well, here, finish that transit. So it's a leftward shift. See that? Because here was the original D1, and it's like I just grabbed it and pulled it to the left for this new D2. So that's why we're calling it a leftward shift in the demand curve. So now what's the new equilibrium? Again, the supply we don't think really would change much just because oranges got cheaper. Why would apple growers care about that? So the new intersection, P2, and the new quantity is Q2. Okay, so don't get mixed up with that arrow right there. Let me just erase that. That arrow was just for the axis there. So let me get rid of that so you don't get mixed up. So now what happens? In the new equilibrium, the quantity of apples goes down, right? Q2 is lower than Q1, and the price drops. So that's going to be a general pattern. When there's a demand reduction, the price drops and the quantity drops. Before, we talked about a supply reduction. There what happens, the price goes up and the quantity drops. Okay, next example, a demand increase, or what's called a rightward shift in the demand curve. But here, so in the text, I kept introducing more innovation so that it wouldn't just be the same thing. So the last one, the quirk I threw in there, the curveball, was that I had the price of oranges change, and then I said, what's going on in the apple market? So that was a little bit confusing. Here, the curveball is going to be the supply curve is going to look funky. So here I'm talking about the market for apartment units. And I'm drawing the supply curve. So here's well, hang on, let me draw a supply curve first. I'm not drawing a regular supply curve. I'm drawing something funky that looks like this. Okay, so notice it still obeys the law of supply, but it's kind of odd. It's saying it's basically in this region from the price of zero up to this price, whatever that is, I didn't label it, the quantity supplied is zero. Then all of a sudden, at any price higher than that in this region, the quantity jumps to this amount. And so the way you would graph that is with this odd-looking thing. So it's just a very strange-looking supply curve, but it still is a supply curve. And so it's a market for apartments. So why is it like that? Because the idea was somebody owns a building. Let's say it has a, you know, 50 rooms in it. If the price is really low, they're just going to hang on to it. You know, they're going to use it to store their furniture. Maybe they'll let their friends or relatives stay there for free. They're not going to rent it out because, you know, there's a risk. If you let tenants come into your building, they might commit a crime. They might burn the place down. They might wreck the place, right? So if the price is too low, you're just going to leave the rooms vacant. But then if it's a building that's dedicated to having tenants, I was going to say, once you get above that critical point where it's worthwhile for you to start renting out one or two units, you might as well just rent them all out. That's the idea. So that's why it has this funky thing where the quantity supplied is zero for all these prices. Then as soon as you get into this range, all of a sudden, boom, the quantity supplied zooms right up. All right. So then I said, what would happen to the price and quantity if some celebrity moves into the building? So here was the original one, D1. So there's P1, and there's Q1. And now I said the star Twilight moves into the building. What's going to happen? I'm jumping ahead because of time. The demand to live in that building, to rent out those apartment units, is going to go up, right? There's going to be a bunch of young ladies who want to live in the same building as that heartthrob. So the demand increases, right? So it's a rightward shift in the demand curve. But what ends up happening in the new equilibrium, the price goes up, right? P2 is higher than P1, but Q1 is the same thing as Q2 in this new equilibrium because the supply curve here is vertical. For this particular apartment, you know, apartment units in this particular building, you can't bring forth more supply. Once you get above that critical price, the owner of the building puts them all on the market. So even though the demand increased, there's no more units forthcoming. So the quantity, so Q2 equals Q1. One comment on this, it's the market is still working. It still does something that the price went up. And you might think that, oh, the price there is just a boon to the landlord, but no, the high price still rations out those units so the people who really want to live in the same building as that guy get to. So that's the function of those high prices there. Okay, one more slide and then we'll wrap it up for tonight. Simultaneously, demand and supply decrease. And again, I'm going through these fast, so office hours, I'll go through these all again if you want to tune in there and see at a more leisurely pace, or just you can watch this video. So here, you know what? Instead of me cramming this in, why don't I just stop now because I don't want to, this is an important one. I'll come back to this and catch this the first thing next week is what I'll do. So I'll do that. All right. And good. No questions pending. Okay, so I'll stop there. Like I say, I will obviously go over these in the office hours if you guys want, and I will do a little mini review at the beginning of next week's lecture because it's pretty critical that you understand this stuff. Okay, well, thanks everybody for tuning in, and I will see you either on Saturday or next week.